the studios of KPCW in Park City. This is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. Well, this morning we speak with professor and scientist Sai Krupa Das from Tufts University's Human Center on Aging and public health expert Raina Goebel. They explore great advancements in precision medicine.
And we speak with animal behaviorist and physiologist Carly Ann York, who shows how what she calls unappreciated, overlooked, and simply curiosity-driven science has led to breakthroughs, big and small. And actually, Katie, I messed up the order of those. We have taped these interviews, and we're going to hear from Carly York first, and then Raina Goebel and Sai Das. So, wanted to also thank you, Katie. It's your last show today, and I'm going to miss you so much. Thank you for your years of hosting this show.
You're welcome. It's been such a pleasure and honor and so much fun, Lynn, working with you, someone whom I've known for 30-plus years, and to have the time together to expand our own curiosities and have some great interviews. I've really enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And best of luck in your upcoming endeavors. And we don't know what they are just yet, but we'll definitely miss you around here.
Thank you. I'll miss you guys too.
And we'll be right back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. Why would anyone research how, for example, elephants pee? Or study worms that tie themselves into communal knots? Or quantify the squishability of a cockroach?
It all sounds pointless, silly, or even disgusting. Maybe it is. However, our next guest, Carly Ann York, an animal behaviorist and physiologist, shows how unappreciated, overlooked, and simply curiosity-driven science has actually led to breakthroughs, big and small. She joins us now to discuss her new book, The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog, and other serious discoveries of silly science. Carly York, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
This book is really fun, but it's also really important in the world of scientific research right now and the funding that lies therein. You start off your story by talking about this conversation you had with this man who was trying to get you to justify what you were doing as a scientist. And, mm-hmm. you know, he was one of those taxpayers who really wanted to know what the value is in real life. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. Yeah. So I was working on my doctorate at the time that this was happening. And I was studying squid physiology. I was specifically looking at like how they avoid predators. So it was definitely curiosity driven basic research. There was no application to this whatsoever that I was planning for. And that's most of my field of animal physiology. We ask questions about animals out of curiosity and without any intent of application. Oftentimes an engineer or someone will come along and say, that's really cool, I can use that, but that's not what we're doing. So I was having lunch with this man, and he asked me about my research, and he was asking me why it mattered. And I genuinely didn't have a good answer for him. I talked about like just the value of knowing what a squid is doing and, you know, like understanding the ecosystem and stuff, but that wasn't like what he was really asking. So I did a really bad job at that. And honestly, it was my husband was with me for this conversation. And he's the one who told me just how bad of a job I really did at that conversation. And as I started writing this book, he reminded me about it. And I'm like, you know what? It's so true. I really did botch it. And I think I'm going to go from there.
Yeah. Well, so you've been musing on that question ever since, you know, for years. And this book is sort of the outcome of that question. Many of us pursue things just out of curiosity. It's curiosity that propels our world forward, and especially in the realm of scientific discovery. The genesis for your book is about this. It's about your argument, and you're defending these things because these small discoveries somewhere end up in this realm of adding to science in a big way. So I'd love you to start by talking about Felicia the ferret.
I love Felicia the ferret. So this isn't a chapter where I am talking about how creative you have to sometimes be in science. So my goal was to show the value of this kind of research, but I also throughout the book wanted to show how the scientific process really unfolds, because I don't think the general public really gets to see that ever. And what we're taught in high school with the scientific method, yeah, okay, we sort of follow those steps, but then we also go all over the place. And I think Felicia is a good example of that. So this was in the 70s, and this group of researchers were building the largest particle accelerator that had been built at the time. And this thing was like 4 miles long. And as they were going testing the machinery, they kept getting failures. And it turned out that they had left some little slivers of metal in there when they were building the machine. And you can't just like take out, like snap apart a 4 mile particle accelerator and clean it and put it back together. So they were really struggling with how to do this. And they ended up hiring somebody onto the team. Their job was just to keep them on budget, which is always also a confining factor. And he was British, and he grew up around rabbit hunting. And the way that they hunt rabbits is by using ferrets. They just like naturally go and dive into these burrows and will catch a rabbit. So he was like, I don't know, maybe a ferret will go run through this long dark tube. So they went and they bought a ferret. That was Felicia. They trained her to run through dark tubing. At first she didn't want to, apparently, and then they worked up to the whole 4 miles. They had a little harness on her with like a rag behind it, and she was wearing a little diaper too, just in case, and they would send her through the particle accelerator, sweeping out all of that metal. So she did that a few times, and then they traded her in for some kind of a mechanical system that was a whole lot less fun than a ferret. But
if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Carly York. She is the author of the new book, The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog and Other Serious Discoveries of Silly Science. Well, let's talk about curiosity in general. I think we are all losing, well, not Lynn and I, because that's all we talk about is what are you curious about? But I think in general, so many people are losing that curiosity element to themselves. Can you talk about curiosity-driven research? In my mind, isn't all research curiosity-driven, but apparently not. What's the difference?
So there's basic research and there's applied research. Basic research is that curiosity-driven research where you're going in with absolutely no plans of an application whatsoever. You just want to know. You just want to get some more information. Versus applied, which is exactly what it sounds like. That's when you are going in with a goal of application. You are trying to either solve a problem or to make a product in particular. So I kind of like to think of it like, think of it as a big scientific tree where the roots are the curiosity-driven research that's underground that you don't really see, and you maybe never even hear of what's happening here, but it is absolutely necessary to support that tree of applied science.
So let's get back to the book, because I want to know about humpback whales and wind power, because they seem like two very different things.
This was a really fun story, and I really enjoyed interviewing the scientist involved in this as well. So this is Frank Fish. He studies animal physiology and in particular like locomotion. And he was walking through an art gallery with his wife, and he noticed a statue of a humpback whale. He saw that it had these bumps on the front part of their fin, and he thought that's wrong. He thought perhaps it could be on the back end. He's seen structures like that before, but just not on the front. And the curator of the museum came like running up to him with a picture and was like, no, it's right. So he was like, wow, that's really weird. I want to know what's going on here. So ultimately, he, after years of waiting, was able to get his hands on a flipper, which I'll leave the details of that to the readers of the book because it's kind of a wild story. And he found that the way that the water moves through these bumps over the fin, it reduces stall. And so stall is like when you're on an airplane and you hit turbulence and things get really uncomfortable, you have stalled. It's basically a condition where there's just a ton of turbulence that's been created. You want to avoid that if you are going to be swimming nice and efficiently. So we noticed that this prevented stall. And it turns out that humpback whales, they eat their fish by creating like a bubble net around them. So they have to get this really big body to turn in a relatively small spiral. And those bumps help to prevent stall, allowing the animal to actually make those really tight spirals that it otherwise couldn't make. So this ends up being applicable in like a lot of weird different ways, including the windmills. So having those bumps on the blades of the windmill help to prevent stall, making it more efficient. We've also seen it on things like fans and on surfboards. So it's been utilized in a number of different ways that just by having the shape, you're able to reduce the amount of turbulence and increase efficiency.
That's a great story. Okay, so would that be then an example of curiosity driven or basic
Yes,
research?
exactly. Yes, he just wanted to know what those bumps do.
Yeah.
And then it took some other eyes to say, I think we could use that.
Okay, so that brings into question how you get funding then for something like that when you're not sure, you can't prove that later on down the road there will be some sort of application for this, and a huge application. I mean, look at these wind generators. It's a huge aspect and a huge portion of kind of our portfolio of creating power these days.
Yeah, that is a bit of a problem. So the NSF was created in 1950, National Science Foundation, and that has been the largest funder of curiosity-driven research in the US. It was created very much with the intent of supporting specifically this kind of research. Problem with curiosity-driven research is that you cannot guarantee that you will have a solution to a problem or a product at the end. So it makes businesses hesitant to invest in research like that. But the NSF was there to support this. Vannevar Bush, who basically created the NSF, he was very, very clear that this was for curiosity-driven research because that is the kind of research that ultimately drives innovation and will get left behind if we don't fund it. And he understood that like by investing in curiosity-driven research, you are investing in like our national security and our health and everything that we see, it sort of stems back from that curiosity-driven research.
So Vannevar Bush had vision, really,
Yes.
had a lot of vision. And I'm wondering how, with the National Science Foundation, NSF, how that has evolved over time. And then what is happening right now with regard to federal funding being cut for the NSF, and how much has historically been federal funding and philanthropy driven funding?
Yeah. So before the NSF, it was largely philanthropy driven in the US, which had its perks and downfalls. So once the NSF was created, you saw this relationship happening between universities and research institutions and the government, where a lot of the money for that kind of research was now coming from the National Science Foundation. And then over the years, it became more and more competitive to get those grants. So when you are applying for a research grant to the NSF, you write up a really big detailed proposal. I mean, these are like 50 to 100 pages with very specific budgets on what you're going to need. And then that goes to a panel of experts in your field. And those experts are going to review what you've proposed. And they are going to decide whether it is feasible with what you have asked for, and if this was something that they can support moving forward. So once that happens, you get the grant. You're held accountable for every dime that you get on this grant. Like, it's not like you just get handed $300,000 and you're done. You're reporting back every year, and you're ultimately writing a really big final report with what you found. So over the years, it's gotten down to about only 25% of grants that are submitted are funded. So it is really competitive to get these grants. So now we are seeing these really, really massive cuts to this, and it's causing a huge disruption both in universities and in research institutions. The NSF budget in 2024 was $9 billion, and we're looking at being slashed like $3 to $4 billion. And at this point in time, I think 50% less grants have been funded than in previous years. So this is causing all kinds of chaos in the world of science in like a bunch of different ways. The way that we support graduate students and train scientists also through these grants. So that has also been a really, really big disruption in how we do things.
Well, Carly, how did we lose our curiosity? Because I think, you know, I love the idea of curiosity being the basically the foundation of this book. And so many people have just closed in the perception of the world, stare at their phones, and aren't curious about even anything going on around them. How did we lose that? Because it is such an essential element of growth and innovation and discoveries.
It really is. And I can't say for sure. I think all of those reasons that you listed are absolutely part of it. So I'm a professor as well, and I spend a lot of time with our college students. And I'll say in a hopeful way, I do see some people who are still incredibly curious about what's going on in the world. It's not the majority, but they are there. And yeah, I think it's easy to get sucked into TikTok and just scroll all day instead of actually looking up and being like, ah, a weird bird. I wonder what that is. Or any other question about just like what's going on around you. So I'm going to stick with the hope. There's still some curiosity out there.
Because I know my brother was recently in Hawaii, and he's curious like I am. And he saw these guys down the beach in very different scuba diving looking outfits, and they didn't know what they were. So he went up and talked to them, and they were free divers training to set the records for depth. And they were just telling him all these stories that he wouldn't have discovered otherwise if he weren't curious. Mm-hmm. I think that how can we bring more curiosity back into our lives?
Oh man, I have the old school suggestions like, you should read, and you should go outside and look around. Those are easier said than implemented, I guess, especially when you have a phone that can entertain you so easily when you're just sitting in your room. I teach a non-major science class. I've taught it like every semester for the past 8 years, and it's my favorite one to teach because I get – this group of students who didn't want to be there. They have to take a science class as part of our curriculum. And they're usually pretty grumpy about it at first. And my favorite thing is by the end of the semester, usually I can at least get them curious. Like it's such a low bar, but that's what it is. Like just to get them to engage with the world around them, get them to start paying attention and get them comfortable to participate in science in whatever way that they can, even if it's just reading an article or looking up a tree species or something like that. So that's how I go about it with that group. Mm. I have a lot of fun with them.
Well, it's great. And there's just something about when your curiosity is turned on and you start to learn, there's this buzz that you get in your body. And being curious creates more curiosity. And it just, it's this upward cycle that is so wonderful and positive. Okay, back to some of these things. You know, I think that of all the different scientific experiments and research that you mentioned in the book, there was one, and you mentioned it in the intro, that I had actually heard of before. And that is about what geckos can do with their sticky little pads. And this was one of those research projects that was curiosity driven and had no immediate application. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So, geckos can climb on walls and walk on the ceiling without falling down. They have these sticky feet, and researchers wanted to know how exactly they were able to do that. It turns out they have a ton of little hair cells on their feet that create this like adhesive force, allowing them to crawl up walls, defy gravity. So from that, we have this like super sticker that got created called GeckSkin, where they've used the same idea of like a bajillion little hair cells in order to have this adhesive force, and it can hold a whole lot of weight.
That's so cool. Up to 700 pounds.
There you go.
On a smooth vertical surface. Wow. Isn't nature incredible? It really is. Well, since I made Katie say in the intro that there's research surrounding elephant pee, I better ask you about that one.
Sure. This was one of my favorites as well. I really wanted to have something about this in the title of my book, and my publisher was like, nope, not allowed. So this was discovering the law of urination, which is that any animal that is bigger than the size of a rat will pee for 21 plus or minus 13 seconds. So a dog versus an elephant will pee for about 21 seconds. And the researcher who did this, his name is David Hu, and he thought that was really interesting, actually, because that shouldn't necessarily be like intuitively. An elephant has a whole lot more blood in their body than a dog. You would think you would see a whole lot more urine getting created in an elephant than in a dog. And what he discovered was that there's this specific relationship between the size of the bladder in animals and the diameter of the urethra. So in that proportion stays the same regardless of how big you are. And that is what creates the 21 seconds, give or take, time period that all animals are going to pee for.
That's great. Okay. Final question, and this is surrounding some of the things we've already talked about, you know, scientific research funding getting cut. I have heard these stories of scientists leaving this country, which may have previously or maybe still is, be the center of scientific discovery. If that is true, you know, could you comment on where they're going and which countries are picking up funding research?
That's a good question. And I don't know, I don't have like a actual knowledgeable answer to that, but I can speculate. I have seen a lot of advertisements from European institutions that are being very welcoming to American scientists. We're going to see an exodus of scientists. We're also going to see that the people who would have come here, the incredibly brilliant people from around the world who would have come here to be educated and probably stay and add to the innovation of this country, they're not going to come here anymore. So we're going to lose some serious brain power, like in both directions. People are going to leave. I had a student who graduated this spring, and she had applied for graduate school before all of this happened. And she is a story A student. She's a gem. Anybody would be lucky to have her. And she was rejected from all of her programs because of this funding issue. So her and I had a conversation about looking overseas, to look in Europe and see what maybe she could find over there. So yeah, it's real.
Well, Carly York is our guest, and she has been speaking with us today on Cool Science Radio about her new book, The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog. We didn't even get to talk about the salmon cannon and the levitating frog, but that is for readers of this wonderful book. I also wanted to ask why you didn't put silly science in quotation marks.
That was a publisher's choice. I had very little control actually over the title and the cover. They let me put whatever I wanted on the inside. Actually, like surprisingly, whatever I wanted on the inside. But the cover and the title was on lockdown with them. So,
Very interesting. Very interesting. Okay. The world of getting your book published. All right. Carly York, thank you so much for joining us and best of luck with this book. It's really interesting.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
This morning, we speak with Sai Krupa Das, a senior scientist in nutrition and aging at Tufts University, as well as Raina Goebel, a nutritionist and science journalist. They join the show to discuss precision medicine and nutrition in an 8,000-person study called the Nutrition for Precision Health Study, which looks at how individual people respond to different foods. Sai Das and Raina Goebel, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Lynn. Thank you, Katie.
Sai, if we could start by having you tell us what the definition of precision health medicine science is. In my mind, it's very simple. It's finding out what works best with our bodies, but I know it's much more complex.
Well, thank you for that question because it's often, in our field, asked of us as to why we need to do precision science and precision nutrition and precision medicine. And it's simply because we have long recognized that a one-size-fits-all approach is not going to work. We're each, unique in our own way, in our metabolism, and as you pointed out, in the ways that our bodies break down nutrients, provide us the energy we need, and, keep us going on a day-to-day basis. And each of us do that in very special and unique ways. And so if you have one formula or one approach that is generalized for everyone, it obviously does not work. And scientists, as well as the public, have basically understood that for a long time. They've known that, we respond differently, we work differently, we function differently. But I think now both medicine and nutrition are perfectly poised or ready for being able to dig deeper and actually be able to understand how and why individuals are different in the way we process our nutrients, in the way we respond to diets, in the way we respond to our health. And now we are ready both with the tools, the knowledge, and the approach to be able to get to being more precise, as the name denotes, with being able to deliver health that is more meaningful, that is customized, and more, appropriate for each individual, their bodies, and their metabolism.
Okay, so then, Sai, could it be as simple as, or could you draw a parallel to something like allergies? We all receive different things in our body differently. And while we all might be able to say, oh, Brussels sprouts are good for you, we should all be eating our Brussels sprouts, if our body responds like it does with an allergic reaction, some people might be allergic to Brussels sprouts and others not. Could you sort of help us out with that parallel between something like allergies and precision medicine?
Yeah, that's a great example, and one that we can all relate to, the allergy example, like you pointed out, right? And so in nutrition and in health, what we really know is that, you know, people process carbohydrates or sugars and, you know, starches different from fats versus proteins. And so there may be a combination that is very unique and different for individuals. And so we cannot say everybody go on a low-fat diet or everybody go on a low-carb diet. We need to make sure that we understand how these nutrients really fit within the context of the individual. And this includes their race and ethnicity, their gut microbiota, which, as you know, is very popular now. You know what happens in your gut and how the microbes that process the foods. And also, you know, of course, age, which has been known for a long time to influence how your metabolism works. And so putting all these pieces of the puzzle together so that it can be really customized for the individual in the way in which they process nutrients. And this could change over time within an individual, but like allergies too, right? You grow in and out of allergies. Sometimes, you know, you have it for life, but these are all the kinds of things that we do in the context of nutrition and nutritional medicine and nutritional health, so that then we can identify what are key or essential factors that really make a difference in the individual, and then customize it for that individual so that the health needle can be moved towards improved health. Yeah.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Raina Goble. She is a science and nutrition journalist. And Sai Krupa Das, she is senior scientist and professor who deals in nutrition and aging. And they are talking about a very specific area, of science innovation called precision nutrition. Well, Raina, you've been covering this topic for years, especially with Scientific America. How have you seen this research field change?
Yeah, I think we see so many times where everyone says, let's all do a gluten-free diet. Let's all do this. Now we're dealing with a whole new era where let's take a weight loss drug and then everything's going to be okay, when satiety and, you know, what fullness is varies from different people, and we need to be looking at whole grains first. So I think that the nutrition area is changing and that we are looking at more precise things, but there's still this disconnect between how nutrition is changing and how it's communicated. I remember seeing these things and I had to argue with someone on Instagram who believed that you should only eat meat and tallow. That's not a great diet for most people. Part of the reason why, after speaking to someone else who believes similar, is they're worried about pesticides on food. So these are questions that we need to have answered when it comes to what's actually on our food. For instance, Mexico won't take our GMO corn. It's because there's actual problems with it, but that doesn't mean that we should give up produce. And then what I specialize in, and with a course at Best Nutrition Class Ever, is to get people the empowerment so they can rotate out foods that would be common allergens that can affect people differently, to see how food affects you individually. So I think the goal is that we move closer and closer to how foods affect you individually, and less towards there's a pill for that. Because if we keep thinking things like Ozempic are the answer or Atkins is the answer, we're going to end up with more and more sick people because they're not solving the actual nutrition deficiencies they have, and they're going to feel way older than they should.
Well, Sai, why is it that nutrition is still so controversial? Because, I mean, it's basic science. There's all of these facts, and we know it works and doesn't work as a general level. But whenever I listen to, say, a podcaster or other scientists talk about nutrition, they always comment, oh, I'm going to get pushback on this. And it seems like it's still very contentious. How is that?
yeah, that's what keeps it interesting, is how I look at it. You're absolutely right. It's contentious simply because, again, one size does not fit all. And people often want simple answers that, you know, make the same sort of get the same outcome for everyone. And that's not true. That's not how nutrition works. And there's also an aspect that we often joke about, which is that everybody eats, and so everybody is an expert on food, right? But beyond that, in terms of the actual science, this is exactly the reason why we're doing this Nutrition for Precision Health study, because there are all these multiple factors that influence our metabolism, that influence what we eat and how we process what we eat. And that's very different at the individual level, right? And we know that, you know, as females here, we can tell the difference between when we were, you know, prior to pregnancy and after, or when we have the postmenopausal period, you know, the metabolism changes. So there are all these factors that influence how nutrients and nutrition really works for us. And so given that there is so much variability, as we call it, right, that's a vast amount of variability that we see across the human species. And so we need data, right? And if you look at a very narrow sort of area, what happens is we will infer or take away from that, you know, narrow area that we've studied. And that is not always true. This is why we always have these conversations. Fat is in, fat is out. But it's because humans really respond very differently. And while a higher fat diet might work beautifully for one individual, it may not for another. And this depends on their metabolism, their genetics, their risk. And so this is why we need a lot of data. And we need what we call in science the evidence base.
Yeah. Sai, you know, well, what you both, Sai and Rena, have already talked about is the tendency to sign on to these trendy diets. And I've always got someone evangelizing to me about why I should be on their diet. And I see people go from being vegan, and that goes along for, you know, a long time in a lot of cases, to finding out, oh, that didn't work for me. And then now they're advocating, you know, all you need to eat is meat. You know, you don't need any vegetables, just eat meat and red meat. And so I'm wondering, Sai, if you could talk about what this does to the body and specifically metabolism.
Yeah, so that is a great point. There's always what we call, you know, fans and, you know, critics for each diet, right? Because there are people who we call responders and non-responders. And an important point that you pointed out, Lynn, is that over time, things do change because your body adapts to what is called the metabolic changes from a diet, or the reactions of, you know, processing a diet and having your system change, both for how the liver, the various organs, as well as your gut or your intestines process this food and then store it or use it, is very different. And over time, that changes. You can also see from scientific studies that over a 3-month or a 4-month period, most diets work pretty well. And then it's over time that when the body gets used to it, that you see these differences. And so essentially what we need to do is to have, again, I keep coming back to this point about data, because individuals and how they, you know, have their health be improved by a diet is something that needs to be studied over time. And what we're doing in Nutrition for Precision Health is looking at it individually in a shorter period of time to see how, you know, the metabolic response would be, and that would help with predicting how individuals respond. So that's our predicting, is basically if we put in the characteristics and the features, we are able to tell how an individual will do with a given diet. So you're absolutely right. There are what's called responders and non-responders to each diet, and, you know, including the keto diet, as you know, which is very, very popular, right? You know, so these diets, however, need to be set within the context of a person and how their, you know, bodily functions, as well as the race, ethnicity, genetics, and other factors are included, are being able to be processed within the human, and then we will be able to get to more meaningful diets that match the individual. And that's exactly the direction that we need to proceed in, and that's called precision science and precision nutrition.
Okay, so Rena, Sai has referenced a couple of times this study in the Nutrition for Precision Health, or NPH. Can you tell us what the study is about and how it, you know, furthers the research or the findings for precision nutrition?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is that I participated in the study as well, and I could tell you my personal reactions to it too. And from the people that were around me, is there were 2 weeks that were low carb, there were 2 weeks that were had more whole grains, and there were 2 weeks that had like one vegetable a day. So speaking of this like vegetable thing, and when I was on the part with soda, my throat was burning all the time. I felt terrible. But then there was someone else there that she was uncomfortable when she had a lot of whole grains. And there was another person that was worried because she was on pills, because we're so used to pills, that her hormones were getting balanced by the whole grains, by eating a normal, healthy diet, that she's like, I don't like this because my doctor has me balanced through medication. I don't want food to change it. What happened was that the person that was having whole grain issue, the reason why she was having a whole grain issue, which also has to do with understanding the mental part of it, is that she wasn't used to a lot of whole grains. This wasn't her normal diet. So what we would consider fullness from eating whole grains felt like bloat to someone else. And so it wasn't the experiences she was used to having with food. So part of it is getting used to what food and fullness is supposed to feel like. And also understanding that your nutrition is not a 2-minute solution. The reason why that I have the 30 days of rotating foods in and out and reading labels, which is much harder for people to comprehend than a diet that just tells you what to eat, but it's the only way to really get to who you are as your chemical reactions to food, what your specific metabolism looks like. And metabolism, I have an MPH, and I still fell for what people told me forever that metabolism is. It's about calories burned. No, it's about how your body reacts to everything that you eat. It's everything. And so I think the MPH is wonderful, and it's going to further science. I was so excited about it. When I started school to get my MPH, it was to do this diet and to get the studies needed to prove to people that nutrition was individual. Because of my own situation where I had allergies, where I was in bed a month a year, allergist had 2 hours of nutrition training, no idea what to do with me. And it turned out soy that she recommended I had more of was what was actually causing the problem when I got tested. So if we do more with this like experiment of figuring out what our particular body wants, and we can do it, and we can have the information to give the doctors our responses. You don't have to have a medical degree for this. In fact, it's the opposite, because the people with medical degrees have 2 hours of nutrition education and they're telling people what to eat. We all need to start learning how our body reacts to stuff and not listen to the people that tell us exactly what to do. And the research that Sai is doing, which is so wonderful, is getting the numbers. I did the first behavioral study on this, an IRB study, on how the reactions and saw amazing results when people just did the rotation. And this is a large scale study that says maybe not everyone should be gluten-free, maybe not everyone should be low carb. And there's gonna be a formula that keeps you both full and may prevent cancer down the line. Over 50% of diseases are nutrition related.
That's a really great promotion for keeping a food journal, because you never know what's going to trigger something. Well, Sai, part of the study that you are working with talks about environmental, social, and behavioral aspects. How do those come into play? Because, we live here in Park City. We have easy access to all this great food, outside, exercise. Everybody around us is healthy. But that's not the case for most people.
Yeah, and that is precisely, Katie, the point here. We are studying these environments because we are part of the term food deserts, where you don't have access to healthy food. And so it may be that there are certain areas where this one type of diet that we're testing, which Raina pointed out was, more processed, is all that they are able to access, both for perishability reasons and other, food security reasons. And so it is the environmental context which really needs to be built in understanding why individuals respond to foods and diets. So we're, you know, as Raina pointed out, doing this study at a scale and depth that has been unprecedented. The National Institutes of Health has really invested in this large study, and we cannot do this precision science if we don't have the numbers. We have the tools, and we have all of this AI, as you know, that can help recognize these patterns and groups of individuals who are of a certain pattern, who respond to diets differently. But without the actual information or data, as you call it, it's really difficult. And so the environmental, contextual, and behavioral factors are very, very critical in being informants, if you will, to understand at the big picture level why individuals respond to food differently. And they are very valuable, they're understudied, and in particular, studying it in the context of the biology and all of the metabolism that we're studying is really important. So we have genetics, we have the gut microbiome, we have environment, we have behavior, we have the context, and all of these factors that will really feed in. And Raina also referred, as you know, to environmental toxins, both in food and in the exposure. So all of that is going to be put into context in the same setting. And that's the beauty, I think, of this study.
Well, Raina, as a journalist, you do a lot of research and you probably spend way more time on the computer and the internet than you like. But for most of us, when we go to look for information, good information, aside from your articles in Scientific American, where should people go? And I'm guessing it's not the yoga shop and crystal store down the street that shares information, because you can find anything you want to reinforce whatever belief you hold. But as a science journalist, what are your most credible sites?
I will go to Harvard Public Health, and I've written for them as well. I will go to the Cleveland Clinic. I read their stuff, of course, Tufts. But I think the thing that you have to do is start off with, I'm an individual, and I'm going to have to learn this myself. I'm not going to know from an article what my body's doing. And so I think that that's kind of the focus. Like if I were to leave people of anything else, whether they do it through my particular course or through a different program or take the LEAP test, which actually is start looking at it as that first. If someone says you shouldn't eat vegetables, find out why. Like look at the why, because there's so much that's just generalized. But health is a great place to look at vitamin information. It's a misnomer that you can't get everything you need from food for the most part. You don't, it's been proven that supplements don't do the same thing as actual food does. And so there's lots of ways to get things through food. And it doesn't mean that you have to have 3,000 calories a day. You also have to watch the claims of vitamins that you've never heard of that people say that you must get in your diet. If you've never heard of it, odds are it's not necessary for you to function as a human being, and you don't need to take that supplement just because you're missing your psyllium or what have you that it says is like your body's not going to function without. People get on all these movements and is like, now you need this, now you need that. And the best aged people that I've ever seen are the people that drink a lot of water. Water is greatly underestimated, like what hydration can do for you. It helps your skin so much. I know the difference in what my skin looks like. It helps your heart. It helps everything. And we also need to drink water in a certain pace. Have it slowly. If you have it all at once, you can actually get sick. So have it throughout the day. If it's really hot outside, have more. There's nothing artificial that is going to do more for you than what your own body can do and real food can do.
It does kind of go back to keeping it simple, but I wanted to ask you, some moments ago you were talking about this, when you did this study where one week was low carbs, 1 week was whole grains, and then 1 week was kind of vegetable based. Is that what it was?
It was 2 weeks, and 1 week, 2 weeks were like junk food, like mac and cheese and one vegetable a day and soda at least once or twice a day. And then there were 2 weeks of more of a diet that included whole grains, so it was pretty balanced, and then 2 weeks of something that was low carb that had things like mayonnaise that I wouldn't normally eat.
Okay. Well, and then you talked about how while something might be good for us, like whole grains, if we're not used to eating them, and if we want to learn a bit more about how they react with our bodies, we can't necessarily just start eating them and expect to know right away. Because if we're not used to it, it may bloat us, or it may make us feel worse for a bit. So I guess, you know, it's kind of tying back into this whole precision nutrition concept of how we get to the answers. And Sai, maybe you can take this and, you know, just talk about the study and how we really get to these answers of what's going to work with us and how precision nutrition gets to that.
Yeah, so specifically, of course, there's the bloat issue, but we have done a lot of studies in which we introduce fiber. As you know, fiber is one that most people will not, you know, contentiously sort of say it's not good for you, except in the case of specific, you know, GI or stomach-related conditions where fiber would exacerbate or, you know, and increase the problem. But the adaptability phase is also very important. I just want to go back to those three diet patterns that Raina was referring to. Those actually are like stress tests. They are not diet patterns that are, you know, uncommon. People in America eat these diet patterns, and we chose three diet compositions really that are very different from each other, and they serve pretty much like a stress test. It's not meant for you to get on a treadmill and do a stress test every day, right? But you want to see metabolically, if you challenge the system, how does the person respond? And so that's where that diet composition that Raina was referring to is going. But with regards to adaptability, you know, there are some diets for sure that are highly processed, like the one she mentioned, where, you know, it is definitely not a question of adaptability. But if it's a higher whole grain or higher fiber diet, there will be a short period where your gut is getting used to it. And then, you know, you don't see those symptoms anymore, which also harkens back to the point that was made earlier, right? You don't study things short term. You look at it over the long time. But that is a different science which looks at which is the best diet. Whereas what we're doing here is to see what are some of the challenges that we can provide to humans and then see how their body responds. And that is a very different question. And that's where precision science really comes in. Where, you know, you may do very well on a stress test, if you will, that is higher carb and lower in fat. But then there may be another individual who does the opposite. And so that's the kind of test that we're doing to get closer to what we call precision science or precision or truth or best fit for individuals. And so, yeah, I know that is sort of an indirect way of answering your questions, but the bloat and stuff are immediate symptoms. However, there are, you know, other factors within nutrients and foods that are, you know, gonna definitely be metabolically different for individuals. And that's what precision is trying to get to. And we have, again, I'll bring up the study. We have 8,000 individuals who are, we are studying, and for a variety of factors, as I mentioned before. And so that essentially is going to give us the kinds of data we need to then inform this precision science better.
Sai Krupa Das and Raina Goebel are our guests. Raina is a nutritionist and a science journalist. Sai Krupa Das, or Sai Das, is a scientist and professor on aging and nutrition science. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio.
And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.